News about the recent presidential election and the mass migration into the United States from Venezuela is often taken out of context of U.S. foreign economic policy and International Monetary Fund austerity programs by mainstream media. In a September 1st interview with Federico Fuentes, writer, activist, sociologist, and director of the Center for Studies for Socialist Democracy, Reynaldo Antonio Iturriza López, said, "If we are genuinely interested in understanding what is happening in Venezuela, we need to instead start with what has actually occurred, that is, with indisputable facts. As this was a presidential election, we need to not just focus on the competing political forces, which of course includes the nefarious influence exerted by U.S. imperialism, but above all on the sovereign, that is, the depositary of popular sovereignty, the citizenry." He went on to say, "This sequence of events of material impoverishment, which is always, at the same time, spiritual impoverishment and drastically affects social ties, combined with an imperialist siege that exponentially multiplied material impoverishment and the political impoverishment from ruling out any alternatives for dealing with the situation, all of which was followed by more material impoverishment, helps at least partially explain the very grave fact that a significant part of the citizenry went to the extreme of considering Venezuela's ultra-right as a visible political option." According to Wikipedia, a fall in oil prices in the mid-1980s caused an economic crisis to take hold in Venezuela, and the country had accrued significant levels of debt. Nevertheless, the administration of the left-leaning President Jaime Lucinchi was able to restructure the country's debt repayments and offset an economic crisis, but allow for the continuing of the government's policies of social spending and state-sponsored subsidies. Lucinchi's political party, the Democratic Action, was able to remain in power following the 1988 election of Carlos Andres Perez as president. Perez proposed a major shift in policy by implementing economic reforms recommended by the International Monetary Fund. Measures taken by Perez included privatizing state companies, tax reform, reducing customs duties, and diminishing the role of the state in the economy. He also took measures to decentralize and modernize the Venezuelan political system by the direct election of state governors, who had previously been appointed by the president. The most controversial part of the economic reform package was the reduction of the gasoline subsidies, which had long maintained domestic gasoline prices far beneath international levels and even the production costs. In response to the government's economic reforms and the resulting increase in the price of gasoline and transportation, a wave of protests and riots known as El Caracazo started on the 27th of February 1989 in Guarenas, spreading to Caracas and surrounding towns. The week-long clashes resulted in the deaths of hundreds of people, mostly at the hands of security forces and the military. Hugo Chavez and his Fifth Republic Movement Party won the 1998 elections and initiated the constituent process that resulted in the Venezuelan Constitution of 1999. According to a recent series of articles in the Washington Post by White House economics reporter Jeff Stein, called The Money War, the Trump White House was warned that harsh sanctions on Venezuela in an attempt to oust authoritarian dictator Nicolas Maduro could accelerate that country's economic collapse and speed an exodus of millions of migrants to neighboring nations, according to three current and former U.S. government officials. Today, however, Maduro remains in power and a surge in Venezuelan immigrants has emerged as a flashpoint in the U.S. presidential election. Though Venezuelan mass migration to the United States only began after President Biden took office, concern among Trump officials about the sanctions' potential effects, including on migration, was more extensive than previously known, according to interviews with more than two dozen current and former U.S. officials. Federal border authorities have encountered more than 800,000 Venezuelans since 2021, although multiple factors, including the effects of the pandemic, have driven Venezuelans to the U.S., their numbers spiked after Biden took office. During a Washington Post podcast, this is how Jeff Stein describes it.
So I've been spending a lot of time recently looking at U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, and there's a huge debate about the extent to which U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, particularly under Trump, starting from 2017 and ramping up through 2020, they were intended on responding to the brutal dictatorial regime of Nicolas Maduro, who was involved in tons of corruption, rounding up political dissidents, regime credibly accused of human rights violations. And under Trump, there was a big movement encouraged by Republicans and Democrats in Congress to really tighten the economic screws to Venezuela in an attempt to encourage their opposition movement. But the way these sanctions worked in practice was they shut Venezuela's government and its biggest source of income, its oil sector, off really from the world economy. And the impact of sanctions to the Venezuelan economy is heavily debated. But if you take some of the estimates as credible, which I do, that sanctions contribute up to as much as a half of the economic impact on Venezuela, you are looking at, in Venezuela, the biggest decline of any economy not at war documented in modern history. And so you saw poverty spike tremendously, tons of instances of malnutrition, people not being able to get food supplies, hyperinflation, tons, you know, more than 7 million Venezuelans have left the country and fled, often to neighboring countries, but increasingly recently to the U.S., the impact on the healthcare system, which was deteriorating because Venezuelans were unable to buy sort of the critical medical goods. I will say, in large part because Maduro and the Venezuelan regime terribly mismanaged the economy of the country, but also because the U.S. sanctions made that a lot harder.
Stein says the unintended consequences of economic sanctions often leave local businessmen without power to fix the economy, giving rise to authoritarian regimes.
A big part of the problem with sanctions is that while the point is to push out the regime or to weaken it, sometimes we find that the elements of a country that are most likely to be able to oppose that regime are themselves counterintuitively and sort of perversely hurt by the sanctions. And so what I mean by that is sanctions will often, for instance, crack down on trade, and often who gets hit by that are legitimate businessmen, a growing, thriving private sector, people who can form a rival power base to the regime. And when that happens, when legitimate private sector trade gets whittled down or weakened, often what happens, this happens in North Korea, in Syria, you see either corrupt actors or the autocratic regime step into that breach.
Ben Norton of Geopolitical Economy Report, an independent research group, quotes from the Jeff Stein series.
Now, what's also interesting is this article notes how the expansion of U.S. sanctions has led to more and more corruption and has in fact created a kind of cottage industry in Washington. It talks about a multi-billion dollar industry that has emerged, including law firms and lobbying shops that have emerged in Washington trying to advise the government and also advise private companies and also lobby for foreign governments to try to lift sanctions or try to figure out how to go around U.S. sanctions. And what has happened is that U.S. sanctions have empowered criminal networks and gangs of smugglers. And this has suffocated the economy of countries like, for instance, Venezuela. This is an incredible fact in this report. The illegal U.S. unilateral sanctions on Venezuela have, quote, contributed to an economic contraction roughly three times as large as that caused by the Great Depression in the United States, end quote. I need to emphasize this fact. This is remarkable. Imagine suffering under the Great Depression in the 1930s in the U.S. with all of the unemployment and the poverty and the hunger. Well, what Venezuela has suffered because of these illegal U.S. sanctions is three times as bad as that. I mean, this is absolutely criminal. Now, what this Washington Post report does not acknowledge is that U.S. sanctions have also killed tens of thousands of Venezuelans. This is according to a report that was published in 2019 by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a think tank in Washington. This scientific paper was published by the prominent economist Mark Weisbrot and Jeffrey Sachs. Mark Weisbrot said, quote, "The sanctions are depriving Venezuelans of life-saving medicines, medical equipment, food, and other essential imports. This is illegal under U.S. and international law and treaties that the U.S. has signed," end quote. And Jeffrey Sachs, a very prominent economist, said, quote, American sanctions are deliberately aiming to wreck Venezuela's economy and thereby lead to regime change, end quote. They estimated that more than 40,000 Venezuelans died from 2017 to 2018, just in those 2 years, 40,000 deaths. And that is a very conservative estimate, because in 2020, a leading international human rights expert and former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, Alfred de Zayas, he took it further and estimated that U.S. sanctions on Venezuela had killed more than 100,000 people, according to his estimate. That was in 2020. We're now in 2024. The U.S. sanctions continue trying to suffocate the Venezuelan economy, creating a depression three times worse than the Great Depression. So even 100,000 deaths is probably still a conservative estimate. Again, sanctions are war. They are not an alternative to war. And by the way, civilian suffering because of U.S. sanctions is not just an unwanted side effect. It is the intended impact. The U.S. government has said this very clearly. There is a famous memo from 1960 that was an internal document published by the U.S. State Department, which has been declassified. And in it, the U.S. State Department talks about ways to try to overthrow the new revolutionary leftist government in Cuba after Fidel Castro and Che Guevara overthrew the right-wing U.S.-backed dictator Fulgencio Batista in Cuba in 1959. In this document, the U.S. State Department acknowledged that a majority of Cubans supported Castro and there was no effective political opposition. Therefore, the U.S. State Department concluded, quote, the only foreseeable means of alienating internal support is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship. And the U.S. State Department insisted that, quote, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba, end quote. And here's the real money quote. The U.S. State Department said that the U.S. government should carry out actions that, quote, make the greatest inroads in denying money and supplies to Cuba, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government, end quote. That is the goal of U.S. sanctions, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. That's what the State Department admitted back in 1960, and that continues being the U.S. goal in imposing sanctions on so many countries around the world today, especially relatively small countries like Venezuela, like Cuba, like Nicaragua, like Syria.
During a Zoom Q&A at the Eugene Art House showing of the August screening of the 2019 film Gaza Fights for Freedom, Project Censor producer Abby Martin was asked about the Venezuelan elections.
This is a battle of imperialism. You can't look at Palestine in a vacuum without understanding all of the other so-called adversaries of U.S. empire and all of the other countries that are under the boot and in the crosshairs of the United States. And Venezuela has been for 25 years. Why is that? Well, they have the largest oil reserves in the world. That's probably first and foremost. It doesn't help that they elected a popular leftist leader on a popular mandate of nationalizing all of their services and providing a big mobilization for poor and working class Venezuelans when Hugo Chavez got elected. So we've seen, oh God, how many coup attempts now? Six? It's a bipartisan pulse that transcends administrations and politicians. And that's how foreign policy works. And so what you just saw, and again, I think a lot of people are confused, rightly so, because the media lies. AP, I just saw AP, CNN, BBC, Guardian. I mean, it doesn't matter what, you know, side of the political spectrum, liberal or conservative, it's all the same. Maduro's an autocrat. He's a tyrant. He committed fraud. He's a dictator. He killed all the protesters. That was a funny one. You know, I went to Venezuela in 2017. It was the height of the deadliest protests in Venezuela. And I embedded myself in the riots. And I risked my life because I honestly was victim to the propaganda as well. I went there wanting to learn with my own eyes. I thought I believed some of it. Because I just didn't know better. And I think a lot of well-intentioned people do fall prey to propaganda because they don't know. Why would we know anything about Venezuela? How would you know anything about Venezuela? So I beg people, instead of thinking that you know something about Venezuela, remind yourself that the same media that has been lying about Palestine 10 months is also lying about Venezuela. And, you know, they have elections every 6 years. And their elections were heralded by Jimmy Carter back 20 years ago as some of the most rigorous, transparent, robust elections in the entire world. They have hundreds of international observers that observe these elections every time because they know week in advance the opposition is going to declare fraud and they're going to decry to Israel and the United States and beg for U.S. intervention. And that's exactly what happened. There's no proof presented, and the corporate media just goes along with it. And I'll just leave you with one thought. Of course, there's a political diversity. Of course, it's not a monoculture. Not everyone's Chavismo, and not everyone's a socialist. No one claims that. That's why Maduro barely eked by. He won 51% of the vote. That's not a mandate. People are suffering. 7 million Venezuelans have left. The economy was in free fall for years. There's real suffering. Real hardships. The problem is that the opposition tries to erase the millions of Bolivarian revolutionaries and Chavismos and Venezuelans who support this project. They try to erase them and they want to privatize the oil. That's what came out from Gonzalez's platform, the opposition candidate who's backed by the U.S. Their first plan of action. Privatize the oil and gas, privatize all the housing. So yes, there's political diversity. The Communist Party split recently. There's 10 other political parties, but really the opposition that's backed by the US is far right. And they got 44% of the vote. And they were begging Israel to actually invade Venezuela back in 2019. Maria, I forget her last name. She's the head of the party. She wasn't the presidential candidate, but she's the head of the party. And she was literally, they fly Israeli flags. Because this is, again, it's like there's not only an international anti-imperialist movement that's very pro-Palestine and Maduro. You know, he's wearing a keffiyeh when he voted and he said free Palestine. You know, it's not just that. It's also Zionism. When you're looking at the international reactionaries, that globalized very, very strong core of the right wing who are very mobilized. Zionism's very core, part and parcel with that. That's why you see Bolsonaritos or whatever the Bolsonaro's fans waving Israeli flags too, because it's become a rallying cry for fascists. So yeah, I think all you need to know really is what the opposition stands for. And that's, you know, it really is revealed, I think, with begging Israel to invade.
If the media reported elections of authoritarian governments in the context of world finance, voters in the U.S. might urge leaders to use more humanitarian efforts such as debt forgiveness and social justice measures instead of the costly turmoil caused by austerity, globalization, and corporate resource extraction. Above all, they might leave citizens of emerging nations to control their own destiny with true democracy. Reynaldo Antonio Iturriza Lopez put it this way: faced with a confusing situation resembling a political labyrinth with no visible way out, I believe it is time for self-restraint and strong character. Actions motivated only by moral indignation will invariably lead to false steps. I am convinced new situations will arise. As I said, order reigns in Venezuela, and with it calm. But it is an anxious calm. The Venezuelan people will have the last word. For KPW News, I'm DJ Sus D.